Well, I'm looking forward to tonight's program, Suddenly Psychic, A Skeptic's Journey. Maureen Cadill is our guest, and we'll be with her in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Maureen Cadill received her bachelor's degree in physics from the University of Connecticut and a master's degree from Cornell University, and she spent more than 20 years as a computer scientist, with 15 of those as a researcher in artificial intelligence and neural networks. Maureen was a program manager and researcher for a major government contractor on advanced projects such as DARPA and ARDA, which is Advanced Question Answering for Intelligence Programs. She holds 3 patents on document and internet search and retrieval technology, and has taught courses on neural networks at the University of California San Diego Extension Program. Some other fascinating things about her life and career: since beginning the experiences described in her work Suddenly Psychic, she has now become an accredited person by the Monroe Institute as a non-residential outreach trainer, and now offers several different shops, workshops, and learning to access altered states of consciousness and incorporating skills accessed in those states in your daily life. She's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hi, Maureen. How are you?
I am fine. A little late for me. It's early in the morning where I am.
You have no idea how late this is going to be for you, Maureen. The fascinating story. Your hotel phones aren't working well. I'm not going to tell people where you are. So you are in the lobby of the hotel, are you not, or somewhere around there doing the program?
No, I'm in the lobby, settled into a nice, comfortable armchair, and happily it's in the middle of the night here, so there's nobody wandering around, and it's nice and quiet.
So the hotel is just going to let you hang there for 3 hours, huh?
Well, let's hope so. Hopefully we won't get too much background interruption from people coming and going.
Well, Maureen, I don't know if our producer told you, but really tonight is a live 6-hour show with you.
Ah!
I'm kidding. Okay. Only kidding.
Well, we'll just do a little time distortion. That should take care of that.
You know, I'm going to talk with you a lot about your career, but you have also learned the technique of spoon bending, have you not?
Yes, I have. It's something I also teach to people in almost every workshop I give.
So is it safe to say that Uri Geller, and he's a friend of ours, is not a magician, that he is truly bending these spoons with whatever psychic talent he might possess?
You know, I was raised on the belief that he'd been proven to be a hoax, and that itself is the hoax. Because not only was I blown away the first time I was able to bend spoons, but I can teach almost anyone how to bend spoons. It appears to be something that is very easy to learn how to do. Almost everyone can do it the first time they try it. So my estimation is that Uri Geller is absolutely the real deal, because so is everybody else.
So let me ask you this. Sometime during tonight's program, is it possible that if we had everybody go and get a spoon, that they might be able to practice? Maybe you can give us instructions over the phone?
I can certainly...
You want to try that as an experiment?
Well, there's a plus and minus on this. I can certainly explain what the process is. Normally when I do a workshop, it's a 2-day workshop, so it runs like all day Saturday, all day Sunday.
Right.
I normally do the spoon bending at lunchtime on Saturday, after the lunch is cleared away.
Then they have no spoon for lunch.
Well, you know, one thing I've learned about spoon bending is never, ever irritate the cook.
His favorite ladle gets bent.
That's right. You never, ever teach spoon bending just before a meal, particularly if it's in a restaurant, because you just never know. I have some great stories about that, actually. The thing that makes spoon bending easy to learn to do is when you learn to do it in groups, because there really is a group energy that gets going.
We've lost her, Tommy. So let's call her right back and get her back on. And let's see if she's there. Are you there, Maureen? Nope. Okay. Well, she's down there in the lobby, so we'll try to call her and get her back on the old telephone. But that, you know what? I think that's what we're going to do. We're in the second hour, and I'll find out from Maureen exactly how long this takes. We are going to do some spoon bending, and we're going to do the technique. And because what I was about ready to tell her is that the Coast to Coast audience is huge, and collectively, we may be able to pull that off. So, Maureen, there you are. And I may have, you know, I was fiddling around with my computer back here. And, you know, I may have disconnected you on my own. I'm not sure. But what I was saying, though, is we have this collective audience that has done some incredible things with our consciousness. Mm-hmm. So let's sometime toward the latter part of the second hour of the three, let's try it. How long would it take? Because I want to time it perfectly for the program.
I have to talk people through doing a little energy raising exercises, and that takes a few minutes to learn how to do. And then the actual spoon bending takes about 10 minutes, maybe 15. It does require focused concentration to be successful at it. So I usually, if I'm on a workshop, this is the thing where I take a break just before we start, and nobody's allowed to enter or leave in the room while we're trying to focus on concentration. It also can get pretty raucous. It's a lot of fun. People just have a blast with it. I have had people spoon bend entire multi-piece services, and, you know, knife, fork, spoon, tablespoon, salad fork, serving spoon, and just a complete service. They just have a lot of fun with it.
Okay, we'll try it. And you know, we can get instant results. We have a computerized system here called Fast Blast where people can send me their results immediately. And we deal on the honor code here, Maureen, and they're very good about that. So we'll get some results. I know when I had Uri Geller on the program, he started up watches and clocks that had since died. Mm-hmm. Some of the batteries weren't even in the watches, and some of them were starting up. It was just amazing.
Yeah, I've seen cell phones ring in the middle when the cell phones were not just turned down and the volume muted, but they were actually physically turned off, and they would come on and they would ring just once, and then they would die again.
Okay, you've got an incredible bio, but I want to know, Maureen, tell me about you.
Okay. I'm not exactly sure what you would like to know about me.
Everything.
Everything.
Well, not everything.
Well, I was a very left-brained, analytical type person. I was in college. My mentor in college was not only a physicist but an experimental physicist who had a very strong belief that if it couldn't, see it, touch it, taste it, put it on a scale, stick a voltmeter on it or something of that sort, that it wasn't real. He thought theoreticians were a little woo-woo out there because they didn't deal with anything like real and solid, like ammeters and oscilloscopes. So I just came up and was educated in that dogma and was perfectly contented with that for many, many years. I tried to maintain an open mind, and I always thought that psychic phenomena were interesting, but had no real belief in them at all. And even if I was willing to go out on a limb and say, okay, certainly these are maybe possible, but I can't do them. I've never had a psychic experience in my life. So it was just something that was completely outside my realm of abilities. I was convinced that all were explainable. When you start working with neural networks and you get involved in that field, people really genuinely believe that the brain is a piece of meat and the computations that it does are perfectly explainable. And as soon as we have the ability to construct a neural network of similar structure and complexity as the brain, then by gum, we'll have a real brain and a mind, and we will be able to create artificial minds. And for many years, that's what I was sort of aspiring to.
What started to change you? What started to make you a little more aware that whatever is in the psychic realm could be real?
I went through a period where I took a break from my career to stay home and look after my mom in the last couple of years. And I realized while I was doing that, that the only way this could be successful would be if I were willing to do it with a very open heart and be willing to do it graciously, as graciously as I could. And it was quite difficult to do that because being a nurse to someone was about the worst possible fate I could imagine for myself. I had no natural inclination to do any of that. Once she had passed away, and actually I experienced like four deaths in the space of 3 or 4 months of people very close to me, in that very terrible period, I realized that what had made it tolerable was I had changed my attitude. And by changing my attitude, I had changed the reality a little bit, so it wasn't this horrific experience I had thought it might be, but instead it was something that where I had grown into a better person, and I probably gained more from that experience than my mother did.
Martin, was there a time that you didn't even believe in the hereafter?
Oh, absolutely. Even after I went back to work, I can remember a year or so after I went back to work, having a very strong conversation with coworkers, where I was absolutely adamant: when you're dead, you're dead. You just stop. That's it. There was nothing more. And I was absolutely adamant about that. Again, as neural networks, believing that the mind and the brain are the same thing. If the brain stops, then clearly mind stops, and what else? There's nothing to continue on.
Well, that is so true. So as you then grew, what did you do to teach yourself? How did you know you were going down the path of righteousness that would give you the knowledge you needed?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, George, because the truth was I didn't know. Somehow, during the period when my mom was ill and in the years prior to that, I'd been working very hard. I hadn't had a vacation in probably 10 years. And for some reason, which to this day I cannot explain, I happened to run across the Monroe Institute website, and I happened to order some of their CDs because I was having, they were CDs on de-stressing and relaxing. I thought, boy, I could use that. I'm really, my job is really nerve-wracking, and I tend to obsess about it a little bit. So I indeed ordered the CDs, and something about them just said, okay, if you get a chance, you ought to go go explore this a little further. So I signed up for the Gateway Voyage program at the Monroe Institute. Never knew anybody else who'd ever been to it. Didn't even really know what the program was, but it was a week-long retreat up in the mountains of the Blue Ridge Mountains in a gorgeous part of the country. I said, what's not to like about that? So I signed up and went, and realized when I got there that it was sort of like falling down the rabbit hole. I felt very much like Alice in Wonderland, because when I got there, it wasn't exactly what I expected, even if I'd known what to expect.
Did it scare you?
It didn't scare me, but it certainly knocked me off balance. I mean, the programs run from Saturday at dinner time to Friday morning.
And Robert Monroe, of course, the late Robert Monroe, well known for projections out of the body.
Right.
He's written a number of books on that. I remember reading his first one. I believe it was Journeys Out of the Body.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago.
Right.
And I mean, the guy was for our modern day astral projectors, he was the guy.
Right, exactly. And Robert Bruce has probably picked up that mantle and carried it on.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, in fact, read Bob Monroe's books. I just didn't connect them. I don't know why I didn't connect them, but I didn't connect them to either the Institute and certainly not to the program I was signing up for. So I get there, and almost the first thing out of the trainer's mouth when she sat down and set up a one-on-one interview. Everybody gets a one-on-one interview with one of the two trainers for the program during the Saturday afternoon before it actually starts. And almost the first words out of my trainer's mouth was, well, now don't be worried if you don't go out of body during the actual program, because only a percentage of people go out of body during the Gateway program. And I just think, going out of your body? What is that?
Yeah, oh, what have I gotten into?
Exactly. You know, what rabbit hole did I fall down? And then the first thing that happens in the program after Saturday dinner, we all gather in a room and they go around the room and everybody introduces themselves. And I realized that of the 24 participants in this particular program, 23 of them were bona fide New Agers. They were meditators. They were shamans. They were healers. They were Reiki masters. They were all these strange things. And then there was me. I was the techie nerd of the group.
Till there was you, right?
Then there was me. And that's when I started thinking, geez, I wonder if I can get my money back. I could always just go hang out in a hotel in Charlottesville for the week. Wait till my plane ticket goes back. I didn't have any idea what I was in for.
What did you learn after that event?
After the Gateway program?
Yeah, yeah.
48 hours into the program, I learned that everything I thought I knew about how the world works was wrong. 48 hours into the program, I had started to channel. I channeled my best friend's dead mom, who I'd never met, but I knew she'd been deceased for a few years. I was precognitive in a big way. In the program, the trainers are very careful to give absolutely no front-loading. You never knew what was going to happen next. And I knew exactly what was going to happen all the time, even though I had no way of knowing what was going to happen. I was remote viewing with dead-on, spot-on accuracy that for at least those two exercises could have rivaled Joe McMonagle. I mean, I was just so exactly perfect. I was doing remote healing on my cat, which had kidney disease. And fascinatingly, when I got back the day after I flew home, the cat had an appointment with a vet, and I took him in to the vet, and the vet was just blown away, couldn't understand why the cat hadn't died.
Oh, fantastic. You did it. You did it.
Starting about the second day, the Sunday of the program, it was shock after shock after shock to my understanding of how the world works.
Starting with doubt, though, before it really got going, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even know why I was there. And, of course, now I look back and I say, clearly I was guided to be there. Clearly my guides were pushing me hard to go down this path. But at the time, I had no idea why I'd signed up for it.
Fate does strange things, Maureen, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It absolutely does. Your spiritual guides and your guides are absolutely waiting for you. And every time I've gone back to the Monroe Institute, I have always realized that my entire week of experience is completely scripted out for me. And it frequently has very little to do with what the exercises are supposed to be doing. I'm notorious at TMI for not following the directions on the exercises. If they say we're supposed to go to a particular focus level, I'm usually off in some other focus level doing something else entirely. And not because I don't intend to do them. I go into the exercise and intend to do them. But, you know, I get halfway into the exercise and, you know, one of my guides shows up and say, oh, forget about that. Come with me. We've got more important things. And I'm off onto some other focus level doing something else completely.
Do you find that when you try to alter fate, change it, control it, that it always ends in disaster?
I find that it doesn't do much good to try and fight it. So I have stopped trying to control my own fate. I work at it in conjunction with my guides, but I let them tell me what it is I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, Maureen, you stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment as we talk about Suddenly Psychic. She is down there in the lobby of a hotel because the phones aren't working in the perimeter of the place. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we will do a spoon bending exercise. So you just might want to have that, the fork or something like that handy. You've got some time to go get it, but we're going to try later. Now the chat is on. Don't forget, it'll be booked for Wednesday night. That's tomorrow, basically, or today, depending on where you may be. We've got the guest chat for you StreamLink members with James McKinney, the physicist. It starts at 8 p.m. Pacific time. Gee, make sure you're part of that. James is a wonderful guest on Coast to Coast, and he is looking forward to doing the computer chat with you StreamLink members. I'll be back in a moment with our special guest tonight, Maureen Cadill, as we talk about Suddenly Psychic, A Skeptic's Journey. Maureen, the book, Suddenly Psychic. Let's take some time to talk about that this half hour as well. Then we'll get into some more psychic experiences next hour along with our spoon bending. By the way, some people are already fast blasting me, telling me that spoons are bending. Now, that's weird. How can that be?
Well, it's not weird. It's weird. But it's what I would expect for a couple of reasons. Number one is one of the real issues that I've had to learn to deal with, particularly coming from a scientific physics type background, is that time is a cultural myth, is not real. It's something that we've all made up. There is a joke, which to me is no longer a joke, which says that time is something that we invented to keep everything from happening all at the same time. And so it is entirely possible that some of your listeners are picking up on energies and explanations that I'm going to do an hour from now. Since time does not exist, and since psychic phenomena are completely outside of time, they could very easily be pulling on those directions and energies right now. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest. Also, while we were on break, I was sitting here running a little energy myself, so they could be tapping into my knowledge and experience of how to do it.
This is going to be exciting. I'm looking forward to this. So you started to put together your work for Suddenly Psychic. How did you begin to build the book, Maureen?
Well, there were two issues that I needed to deal with. One is, of course, starting at that Gateway program, but also in the years since then, I have experienced a lot of very strange things. And some of those strange things have really shaken my understanding of how the world works to its very core. When in looking at those experiences, they're data points. I'm a science trained person, so to me they were data points. Now the thing is that if you're really doing science and not doing faith or religion, mm-hmm. If you have experiential and experimental data that fall in one direction, and the data contradicts your theory of how the world works, you have two choices. You can either ignore the data and stick with your theory, or you can say, okay, the data is what's real. I now have to change my theory to match the data. Well, science is supposed to be about believing the data. If you have information, if you have experiential data, then the data is what's important, not your theory. So I ended up with basically three choices. I could either assume that I had suddenly gone psychotic and
you don't want to do that, but you're right. Always that possibility with any of us.
That's right. Had I gone psychotic, the other possibility was that I had somehow managed to hoax myself consistently, even when in circumstances where, these experiences took place in a wide variety of circumstances, some in public, some in private, some with lots of people around. Generally, they happened when I was trying to do something else entirely. So I couldn't even chalk it up to intentionality in all cases. Or I could say, okay, the experiences were real. Now I have to find a way to reconcile what I know about how the world works, that's science, with data, with what I've experienced. And I choose not to believe I'm psychotic, primarily because I'm still pretty functional in the real world. I choose not to believe I've hoaxed myself, simply because the concept of hoaxing implies deliberate intent. And as I said, a lot of times these experiences have happened when I've been trying to do something else entirely and have not been trying to do whatever mm-hmm. happened. And so that meant I really had to work hard to try and say, is there a science that can help explain how spoons bend, how remote healing can happen, how I can remember the future, how all of these things have happened, can science explain these? And I started looking into current theories of in neurobiology, in psychology, in physics, starting with quantum physics. A lot of people like to explain psychic phenomena with entanglement in quantum particles. That's not a very good explanation, in my opinion. But string theory, there's membrane theory, there's some really new cutting edge theories, like Laszlo's Akashic Field theory. When you start looking at cutting edge theories in physics and cosmology, you realize that if these theories are right, a lot of psychic phenomena just sort of fall out of those theories. They become not only reasonable, but almost expected if these theories are correct.
So when you put this together in your book, was it more of a how-to book, or is it more of a this is what happened to me book?
It's a little bit of, it's about 50% of this is what happened to me, but the way it's organized is I take, okay, I had this experience. Now, can I explain this experience with current scientific theories? And I go into the science of what might explain that theory. And then I go into another experience. So the theories are tied to actual psychic experiences that I've had to make it both more personal and more easily understandable. I try to keep the science, although I visit a lot of different scientific areas, I try to keep it very understandable. You don't have to know anything about quantum physics. You should be able to sit down and read this book and hopefully enjoy it.
Do you try to convince your former colleagues, scientists, people who don't believe in this, that you were wrong and there's something else out there?
I don't try to convince anybody of anything. I encourage people to go out and have their own experiences because, in my opinion, for example, when I'm teaching spoon bending, I don't stand up in front of people and bend spoons because no matter how you do it, no matter how carefully you do it, there will be a way that somebody can say that was faked.
Well, I was going to say, why don't you take Amazing Randy's $1 million offer?
It's not a real offer, because it's a rigged test. He is the sole judge and determiner of whether you pass it. He has a million reasons to say you didn't pass it, and he is notorious for changing the criteria after the fact. I understand now that he now has a screening process so that only people who pass his screening are even permitted to take it forward.
Yeah.
And the people I know who are genuinely talented and psychically skilled and have good practice have been rejected because they're successful in that screening test. So he doesn't even allow anybody who's legitimate to take the test anymore.
Okay, but your friends who are skeptics, and I'm sure you still have some,
right?
Do they think you're nuts?
Oh, they think I'm a little strange. But what I encourage people to do.
But they knew you before this metamorphosis, didn't they?
Yes. When I came back from the Gateway program, from that very first Gateway program, about 2 weeks after I'd been back, my best friend pulled me aside one day and she says, who are you? Are you a pod person? And what have you done with my friend Maureen? And I said, what? And she said, you're not Maureen. And her problem was that I no longer was obsessing about career issues and work problems all the time. I was in the middle of a major career crisis at the time I went to the program, and I no longer obsessed about it. Why? Because the last night at the Gateway program, after it was actually over, I was just sitting out at a picnic table looking up at the stars and saying, geez, I wonder what's happening in this big career crisis I'm going through. And I just was infused with this sense of knowing, this sense that it would all work out just fine. And it did. I didn't have any idea how it was going to work out just fine, and it took about 2 months after I got back for it to work out just fine, but I knew that it would. And so as soon as, from that moment, it never bothered me anymore. All I did was say, I know it's going to be fine.
Again, that is letting fate or the cosmos just run with it.
Yes.
And, you know, earlier when I was saying, you know, when you try to change it and, you know, and position it, we either screw it up or it just doesn't happen the right way. You've just got to let it happen. And I wish, even with myself, Maureen, mm-hmm. you know, and I've been doing this for all my life since I was a kid, I still try to alter my fate. And in rather than just let it go with the flow,
right.
there are times in my life, and I'm doing it now on certain things, that I try to get into it or manipulate it, and it screws me up, and I know better.
You know, I have a very current example of that. I just moved last week, as a matter of fact, to a new house. I moved from one town to another town that's about 40 miles away. And I had been planning this move for about a year. I had been planning it for a specific reason, because I was planning to take certain steps of in my life. And I had planned on it. I had done everything. I had got all my ducks in a row to do all this. And had my house on the market. And just as after the house had been on the market for some time, I realized that another opportunity was dropping into my lap, and that maybe I didn't have to make this physical move. Mm-hmm. And I decided, okay, on Monday I'm going to take the house off the market, and I'll just stay here for another year. And that weekend the house sold. Now, it hadn't sold for 9 months, because I live in a fairly slow real estate market.
Sure. Yeah,
and
it hadn't,
so the house sold. And I thought, okay, let's just go with it. Let's just see if I can find a house where I had intended to move to. And sure enough, all through the process, every single time I had a point where I could break off and not move and not move it into this specific house that I moved into, I made the decision, okay, tomorrow I'm going to do that. Every single time something swept me back so that I ended up moving into this house at this place, at this time, and I have no idea why, because the original reason why I was moving to this new town has now completely gone away. It's not going to happen. Instead, I'm going to do something else. So, obviously, something wants me in this house, in this town. I have no idea what that reason is. I'm just agog with curiosity to find out what that reason is, why I'm supposed to be in this house, in this town. I'll find out probably sometime in the next year or two. I have no idea what it is right now.
During your skeptic days, were you a believer in a divine creator? Were you a believer in God?
No, I was an absolute atheist.
Has that changed too?
Absolutely. And a lot of that is because when you begin to access these deeper, these very, very deep meditative levels. One of the skills that I have discovered in myself is that I'm very, very good at going extremely deep. I can go very deep and with just a slight effort, and it's not hard for me to go very, very deep. And when you start going into these really deep levels, the high focus levels that Monroe calls them, you actually start connecting with God. You start experiencing that oneness that is indescribable and yet is completely unmistakable, and that every religious tradition throughout the world describes something like that. And once you've experienced that for real once, it never goes away, and you are left in absolutely no doubt of what is true and what is not true.
That's pretty dramatic.
It was huge. It was huge. There's no other way to say it. I mean, like I said, my entire life, everything I thought I understood about how the universe works, it turns out is wrong.
Everything, Maureen?
The fundamental assumption on which all science is based. All science of all fields is time zero. That is, there's a cause and there's effect. If you do a cause, and if you do something and act A and B happens, then A, and you do it again, you do act A and B happens again, you can say that A causes B. That's simple causality. Time runs from the past to the future. I have had direct personal proof that is unmistakable that time's arrow is not true. I have actually performed causes after the effect. Now, if you give up causality, if you give up time's arrow, that causes have to come before effects, there's what's left of science. Because that's what science is, the study of cause and effect. Whether you're in chemistry or physics or biology or any science, it's all cause and effect. But if cause and effect, if causality falls apart, if there is no time, then guess what? Everything that science rests on crumbles away.
Do you believe in evil?
You know, I didn't used to believe in demons and evil because I had personally never encountered them for a long time. About 2 years ago, one of my friends was suffered an attack from a demon, and we used to do joint meditative sessions, and I actually came face to face with a demon that was attached to her, and it scared the life out of me. It was very, very scary. So, yes, I do believe in evil, and I do believe in demons, because I've seen them.
They are there.
They are there.
Why do you think you did not see this, though, before this epiphany that occurred for you?
See the demons and the evil?
Well, everything.
I believe, you know, when I was a late teenager, I had an earlier call to walk down this path. And I ignored it. I turned away from it. You know, Chris, I'm a novelist too, and Chris Vogler has written a book called The Writer's Journey. It talks about all stories have the same basic structure. It's the hero's quest story that Joseph Campbell came. All good stories have the same hero's quest. And they all start with a call to adventure to your hero. The hero in his ordinary world receives a call to adventure, and typically the hero refuses the call and has to be persuaded to go on this quest. I mean, if you think of Lord of the Rings or the Star Wars or any of these phenomena, I mean, Luke Skywalker originally turned down Obi-Wan Kenobi's offer to go rescue Princess Leia because he just didn't think he could do it. I turned down the first call that I got when I was a teenager. And the result was when I got the second call several years ago, the call I got was louder and harsher. And instead of having the tap on my shoulder, I got a 2x4 whapped upside my head saying, okay, you didn't listen to the first one. Now you're going to get the same call, only it's going to be worse. So I think I had to be mature enough and ready for it, and I just had to be at a personal place where I was primed and ready to listen. And I had the knockabouts with having so many losses in such a short period of time. It just prepared me to get the call.
Well, let's, when we come back, check in about these altered states, what you really believe could be occurring out there in the psychic world. Go get your spoon, go get your fork. Next hour, during the hour, we'll do our spoon bending experiment as well, so get that handy. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let me check the cave here, see if somebody left me an old spoon or fork.